Well, thank you for that introduction. I don't know if you got my name. Just give me. Give me the hair because I'm so darn nervous. The two guys are going to help me with that because this, in my opinion, isn't meant to be me just sharing with you. I'm here to have you be a part of sharing with me as well. Because the most important thing that I learned from the experience with my mother, and you'll have to forgive me because it's a very touching part of my life, probably the most significant thing that's ever happened to me. But the most important thing that I learned from the experience is how incredibly important the individual soul is and the oneness of each human being coming together and being a part of each other, in some way finding a way to drop the walls that we place around our hearts. I'm excited especially to talk tonight because I was talking with one of my friends today. She's right here, Diana, and I want to acknowledge her for all the wonderful friendships she's given me over the years, and my daughter and her husband, who are going to help us a little later. Everyone that's been able to help me. But I'm really excited because I remember when I was a little girl, I remember reading Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, and I gave it to my mother. That was in the beginning of my spiritual walk in life. And I remember I was so excited because I wanted to share that with her. And she read it. I remember over those years when I was young thinking, boy, I wish I could have that experience someday, but I don't want to die to do it. That's what I remember thinking. And, you know, be careful what you ask for because they always say you might get it. Well, I'm not sorry. I'm glad I wasn't careful about that because I had the beautiful experience of seeing my mother at the moment of her passing. As we talk today, I really want to make this an interactive experience. And as you can see, I have a picture of a butterfly up here. What comes to your mind when you think of butterflies? So yell it out loud. Flowers? Flying? Transformation. Okay, anything else? Beauty?
Freedom.
Metamorphosis.
Freedom, metamorphosis. Anything else? You hit all the good highlights, the most important things. And that's what we want to talk about tonight, because what I have learned from the experience I have is that death is not the end. It really is a transformation. And it's a graduation. You know, in my faith, and I hope we'll put down any barriers here tonight about faith, because one other thing I learned from the experience I had is that there are no boundaries in the faith. We all believe in the same one power. We all believe in, we may call him different things, we may have a different understanding of him, but I understand him to be Jesus Christ, the Savior. I want to be able to speak about that freely tonight, and I believe that you'll help me to do that because that's what we're here for. We all feel, if we're not here to transcend these barriers, that's what death is all about, is transcending a barrier. So I'm going to speak tonight in terms of my faith and my experience in terms of my faith. But when I speak in terms of my faith, you put in there your own experience of what you believe in, okay? In this transformation, I think of two quotes. This was the first one. You've all heard this before. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings of light, having a human experience. And you all know that when you go right down to the bottom of what makes us up, our DNA, it is absolutely nothing but light, power of light. And so that's the first thought that came to me. The next one is this by William Wadsworth. Our birth is but a forgetting, not in entire forgetfulness and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. So those are the first two things that I thought about when I got ready to speak to you tonight. I'm going to talk to you about a number of different things, and I'm going to define for you the difference between a near-death experience and what I experienced, which Raymond Moody spoke a couple months ago about, which is called a shared death experience. And I was so excited when he talked about that because I didn't know anyone else had that experience, you know, before me. I mean, I wasn't thinking that I would be the only person in the world to have it, but I just didn't know about anybody else. So I was really excited when he talked about that. The most important thing about the near-death or shared-death experience is this thing right here. That's number one. And anyone who's ever had this experience, I know, feels as if when they come back that their life has been changed. And so what I learned from my experience with my mom is that at the time of death, there really is like a portal. And there really is an opportunity, not only when they transform and when they change, but if we are open and willing to let in that spirit when the worlds are closed, then we're allowed to have a very spiritual opportunity of change ourselves. And so what I learned was that coming back and sharing with you the experience of change that I had, and the feeling of desiring so much for people to understand this feeling of love that is over there. It's just so powerful. Death is only a bridge to everlasting life. It's a bridge. Now, when you think of a bridge, what do you think of? Crossing over.
Two ends.
Anybody else? Safe passage. Connection.
A gulf or a chasm,
okay? The thing that comes to my mind when I think of a bridge is a place for someone to walk over. Now, the reason I bring up a bridge is not only because the bridge of death, that death is a bridge between worlds, okay? It's a place where we pass through. But the reason I bring it up is because I want you to think of tonight as a bridge in your life. I want this experience, and I really pray hard about it, and I hope I succeed at it. I want this experience to be for you a bridge, a place where you pass from what you felt before you came in here into something new, that hopefully you'll have a bit of an experience like I had and go through. That's what I really want, is for you to feel in your heart a little bit of what I felt when I saw my mother pass over. I'm going to play a song for you. I want you to, if we can bring the lights down just a little while I play it, I just want you just to really let yourself relax a minute and just really listen to the words of the song.
Everywhere and every day. One power indescribable, and you speak of it with every word you say. Mysterious until you know the truth. As simple as the love inside of you. Call it God, call it Spirit, call it Jesus, call it Lord, call it Buddha, Allah, angels, wings, or heaven's door, but whatever name you give it, it's all one power, can't you see? It's the power of the love in you and me. One power. Only dangerous when we forget that in the heart we're all the same. We'll remember once we close our eyes to see that such differences remain. It's the freedom of forgiveness. It's the sweetness of release. It's the joy of inspiration. It's the sunshine on your face. It's the birthright of all nations. It's the boundlessness of space.
Because that's what I want you to feel. There is a connection between all of us. And what I learned from my mom and what I saw was that that connection goes on. And it's so powerful. And we just have no clue down here. We just have no clue. Peacemakers. That's what a shared death and a near-death experience has been about for me. When you see this, what comes to your mind? Comforting? What's comforting? Okay, you see the physical embrace. I'm glad you saw that first. How come you didn't see that big block?
I just focused it on the left corner.
Awesome! You focused on the left corner. How many of you focused on the right corner? How many focused on that big block falling on top of everybody? No? How many focused on the hug? Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Now, why do you think you focus on the hug?
Because it means something to you.
Because it means something to you. I gave it away. Okay, but now let's look at that. If you were to, okay, think of the different experience of this big old block falling in the center of the sea of humanity versus one hug starting in the middle. What's the difference?
One will destroy the other, and one will bring peace to each other.
Absolutely. And that one little embrace, okay, do you think it can spread?
Yeah, it does.
Absolutely can spread. And it can spread even when you embrace the hardest person to embrace. That's the most important thing. When you embrace, that's what a peacemaker is. Even when you embrace the hardest person to embrace, it will still spread. The reason I'm trying to set a stage here, because there are two different kinds of experiences that I've learned now. The near-death experience, and these are some of the intense feelings and things that people experience when they go through a near-death experience, and it's very same for what I experienced. But I highlighted the intense feelings of unconditional love and being accompanied by a loss of fear and death. Because, like I said, when I was a little girl and I wanted to have this experience after I read about it, I was like, I don't want to die to do it, because I was afraid of death. Now I'm going to give you a little background about it. And my mom. Okay, I was kind of an unusual child. I would sit in my room at night and read the Bible when I was 6 and 7 years old, try to read it all by myself. Nobody taught me that. It was just something I felt like I wanted to do. I don't know why, but I had an uncle die when I was about 7 years old. And he was pretty close to our family. We spent a lot of time in his house. And so when he died and all of a sudden he just disappeared, it was really upsetting to me. I didn't understand it. And then that was kind of in a period of time when people didn't talk to little children all that much about death. You know, it was kind of like, you know, they're there to be seen but not heard. And you didn't include them as much back then in these adult situations. They just sort of, I don't know if adults just assumed we knew what was going on or what, but they didn't talk to me about it. And it was really upsetting to me. And I didn't understand where he'd gone. And I remember the night that I came down from my bedroom upstairs, and my mom and dad were having, I remember it very well because they were having lobster at about 11 o'clock at night. And I didn't know what lobster was, and I was like, wow, what's that, you know? And so I remember I'd been laying in my room for like 2 or 3 weeks crying because my uncle had disappeared, and I didn't understand it. I finally came down and let them know how I was feeling, and I cried. And that was the first time my mom and dad ever talked to me about this higher power, and they talked to me about Christ. And at that time in my life, it was important, because when they told me that he was helping, would help us with this bridge to cross over, well, then it was important to me to find it and talk to him, okay? I started looking for him, and I looked in a lot of places. Elvis Presley was one of them when he used to sing his gospel music. And I went to all the, you know, early stuff like Superstar and Godspell and all that stuff, you know. But I remember that it was really, and I remember it was in the 60s too, and I'm dating myself. It was in the 60s, and I remember thinking, well, he has long hair, so he's probably in California. And so that's where I was going to go when I got, you know, my own freedom. I was going to go to California and find him and talk to him and find out if this is all true. That's what I wanted to know. Over time, I had quite a spiritual walk of my own, and like I said, it was an unusual. I started very young, and I was very earnest about it. And I always have been very earnest about it. And I eventually had a great conversion experience as a Latter-day Saint, and it was a powerful experience for me. That sets the stage, and now I have my mother and my father, who were not of any particular spiritual inclination of any kind whatsoever. Although they sent us to church, but they weren't that committed, either one of them themselves. So over the years, that really bothered me, because when I was a little girl, the thing I really wanted to know when my uncle died, when I talked to my mom and dad, was, well, if Uncle Paul can disappear, that means Mom, you can disappear, and that means Dad, you can disappear, and then what happens to me? That's what I wanted to know as a little girl. It was very important for me to find an answer, because the thing I wanted more than anything was to be with my loved ones. Always, I didn't want that love to go away. The difference then with the shared death experience is what Raymond Moody says on the second paragraph there. It's a phenomenon where the near-death experience is actually shared by someone who is not dying, who is emotionally connected or in close proximity to someone who is currently in the life-death transition. These kinds of NDs attain a higher validity when it occurs where there is significant physical or social distance between the two individuals. How many of you got that little email that they sent out about my experience? Did you read that I was on a plane when this happened? Now I'm going to give a little bit of background about the story with my mom. My mother was diagnosed in 2005 with a disease called scleroderma. And she had the worst kind of that disease called pulmonary arterial hypertensive scleroderma. And any of you ever heard of this? You have. Wow, I'm glad to know that. Because part of my wanting to share the story is because I want to make people aware of this disease, because it's fairly, fairly unknown. It's a disease where basically, in general, what happens is the collagen in the body begins to overproduce. It's an inflammatory and an autoimmune disease, and what happens is it starts to kill off the arterial cells in the body and the smooth muscle cells, and it actually, with the pulmonary hypertensive part, there she is, thank you. With the pulmonary hypertensive part of the disease, because the collagen starts to overproduce just insidiously, it starts to harden pretty much everything in the body very slowly. So it starts to harden the skin and eventually it works its way into the organs. And once it gets into the heart and the lungs, that's where the arterial part. Because what it does is it starts to squeeze off all the vascular system so that the heart has to pump very, very, very hard even while you're at rest. And eventually the heart just wears out and eventually the kidneys and the liver and everything go. And my mother was the most gracious woman I've ever seen in an experience like this. Basically, when I found out that she had this disease, you know, I've been 25, 30 years here in Salt Lake, something like that, and hadn't really been around her a lot, except when my daughter and I went there for Christmas and summer, and, you know, maybe two, three times a year, spent a week or so. When I found out she had the disease, I was just devastated. The first thing that I felt, and you go through the stages of mourning, you know, in your own way, the first thing I felt was just this overwhelming feeling of guilt. Like, did I do enough for her as a daughter? Was I there enough for her? Did I make a difference in her life the way she did in mine? And I hoped that I did, but I sure wasn't sure. And so I made a kind of a deal with my Lord that I was going to do all I could to be there for her in the way that she'd been there for me, because she was my cheerleader all through my life. And so I was going to be there for her in the ways that she'd been there for me. And so I kind of made this decision that I was going to do whatever it took to be able to spend as much time with her. The only problem was she was way out in Minnesota and I was way out here. And so it turned out that basically for the next 3.5 years, I went forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I probably spent, in that 3.5 years with her, I probably spent about, I would say, maybe 60 or 70% of my time with her, taking care of her needs as she slowly deteriorated over time. It was really a profound experience serving her, because the thing I want to tell you about her, and that's why I want you to see her, is that I've never seen a person so gracious with such a debilitating disease. And that's what she did for me. The thing that she taught me was how to live by grace. Talk about this in terms of living grace and disgrace. You know, we have a choice in life how we live, and that's what my mom taught me. And I tell you how, my daughter and I have often talked about this. We've said, you know, whenever life kicks us, I'm the loudest person to scream. and I whine and I whine. And she taught me that there's a better way to be. And that was the most important thing that she taught me through this. Now, I want to tell you about the experience, but it's so hard for me to say it in words. So the easiest way for me to do it, because what I learned was that after it happened, I found that if I could talk to a person who really had a confident faith, it was really easy for me to share. But if there was someone who wasn't certain or felt a little bit skeptical, it was very hard for me to share. Over time, as I shared the experience with a number of people, I learned a lot of things about this experience. When I wrote about it, I can express myself so much better when I write. So when I wrote about it, I was able to express it a whole lot better. Okay, now the first thing I want to tell you is really, when I came to do this talk tonight, when I was here earlier, the guy that was helping me set up was doing some blonde jokes on me, and I said, that's okay, because I have a couple of blonde jokes of my own. And the first one is, what do you call an eternity? You ready? Four blondes in four cars at a stop sign. And we're going to talk about eternity in a minute. Okay, and the next one was, why do blondes always smile when there's a lightning storm? They think their picture is being taken. And this experience happened during a lightning storm, and that's why those two jokes stuck with me when I heard them this week. Now that you know that I spent 3.5 years caring for my mom, which was extremely vital to me, I had a health problem of my own for that last year while she was going through the last hardest year. And I had put it off and put it off and put it off all year. I finally had to take care of it. And while I was in Minnesota, I was going to go see some doctors there. And in fact, I did go see the doctors there. Found out that their prices were like thousands of dollars more than Utah for the same thing. And since I'm in charge of my own insurance and my own medical bills, I decided to take the trip home and do it here. So I was with her up till the month before she died. And I remember the last day that I was with her. I'm a dreamer. I've been a dreamer since I was a little girl. I see things a lot that are going to happen before they happen. I had this dream about my mom about two days before I left. And it was the most awesome dream. As debilitated as she was in a chair all the time, 24 hours a day, or in her bed with oxygen 24 hours a day. So as debilitated as she was, when I had this dream, I knew exactly what the message was for me. I dreamt that she was going to bed one night, which we all did at the end of the night. In fact, I remember one time when she rounded the corner of the bedroom and she, you know, my brother and myself and my father, we would all gather together by her bed and to say goodnight. And the first time we went in there and kind of all gathered when I came home, she came in and looked at everybody sitting there waiting for her on the bed. She said, "What is this, the community meeting?" And after that, she could never go to bed without all of us gathered there on the bed with her. And we always said prayer at the end of the night before she went to bed. This dream I had, she was in the bedroom, and I was hopping by to go to the bathroom at the end of the night, and she looks through the door, and she's just like a little kid, like she was so excited. She was, and I came in the bedroom, and she goes, "Watch this." And she takes her oxygen mask and she just rips it off and throws it on the floor, and she starts dancing like a ballerina. And I knew immediately that it was her time. That Spirit, the Lord, was telling me it was her time. She needed to be free. She'd gone through all she needed to with this experience. When I had the dream and I knew I had to go, and I knew I might not get back to her before she transitioned, it was very hard to make the decision to go. But I had to make it. And I will say the Lord helped me with it, because that last day I was with her, we sort of had a bit of an argument. Believe it or not, we did. And I was just sick to my stomach about it. And I left for a little while to go by myself and kind of get myself back together. And I went to the farm. I drove 10 miles to the farm of a man that was a dear friend of mine and my daughter when we were young. And I walked, and it was abandoned at this point. This farm was just total wreck. But I walked in the door, and I walked in, and I sat down on the couch. And I was thinking about her, and thinking about going, and thinking, what if she's not here when I get back? And I need your help. I need your help. Because I have to say goodbye then. And so I sat down on the couch, I said a prayer, and I had this impression to walk across the room, over to the shelves, and I walked over across the shelves, and I looked up on the shelves, and there was a Bible sitting up there, a red Bible, and I pulled it down. I opened it up to this page that had a sermon in it. And it was my friend's mother's sermon, and she was just like a mother to me and my daughter for a long time. It was a sermon about that God's timing is perfect in everything. Basically, it said that with the eye of faith, you can see God is moving in everything. The thing is you've got to create these eyes of faith. You gotta ask for help to create. And so I knew when I saw that sermon that the Lord was with me, and he was letting me know that I could see the faith in all of this. I could see his hand moving in it, and I had to trust, and I just had to take it as it would come. I went back home. Of course, Mom and I made up, and when I got ready to say goodbye, the thing I remember most is the look in her eyes when I walked out the door. She used to sit in this little chair beside the living room patio window, and she could hardly use her arms that much. She didn't have much strength. She could barely get around the house at all. But she leaned forward and gave me this whole body embrace. She'd always just give me this whole soul embrace. So when I walked out the door, our eyes met, and I knew when our eyes met what was going on. And I think she knew too. I went home, had my tests, and I was going to come back a month later. I was going to get these tests done, and my follow-up appointment was for August 27th of that month in 2008, and I was going to come back as soon as I got done with that appointment. On the 26th, I called her, on the 26th of August. I used to call her all the time in the morning. She'd call me on the weekends and say, three minutes, because she was always concerned about my cell phone. But I called her that morning. I knew. As soon as I heard her voice, I knew. I called my doctor. I canceled my appointment. I knew that I had to get home right away. I packed up my car that day. I was just going to get in the car and drive home the next morning. And I made that trip many times. And in the middle of the night, I went to see a friend who was going to give me some music that I wanted my mother to hear before before she was, you know, gone. I was driving back, it was a couple hours south of here, and I was driving back in the middle of the night, and I got this phone call from my dad about 1 o'clock in the morning saying she was gone. Or not, sorry, not that she was gone, but that she had been life flighted to the hospital. And he said, "This is it, Kara. She's not going to recover from this. You need to come home." So here I was the next morning, frantically with my roommate here, Laura. We were frantically trying to get me a plane, and I made some foolish decisions that morning, but I ended up missing the only flight out at 10 o'clock that morning. I wasn't able to get a flight until 5 o'clock that evening. I waited in the airport all day while Diana took care of me and kept me from going crazy. I got on the plane at 5 o'clock. We flew into Denver. We were supposed to have an hour layover in Denver. It ended up being 2 hours, and it was about 9:30, 10 o'clock when we got back on the plane. We were supposed to land in Minneapolis at 11 o'clock that evening. When we got to Minneapolis, by the time we got there, there was an electrical storm in Minneapolis. We circled around the airport for an hour or more, maybe an hour and a half. So now I missed the first plane. I sat in the airport for 7 hours. I went to Denver, was supposed to be there 1 hour, was there 2.5 hours. Circled Minneapolis for an hour and a half, or an hour, and they finally flew us all the way into Cedar Rapids, Iowa to refuel our plane. What are you thinking at this point? I'm wanting to get home to my mother, but what are you thinking? There's a reason. It sure seems like somebody else is in control, doesn't it? That's what I learned. So what happened is when I got back on the plane, and in fact, when we got into Cedar Rapids, my plan was to get off the plane as quick as I could, get a rental car, and drive as fast as I could. I might get there by 3 in the morning. But no, we landed in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and what did they tell us? Nobody deboards the plane. There is no gate for this airway, for this airline. Nobody, you're sitting here for another hour. So by the time we finally left there, we came up over, it was probably about, I'm thinking 1:30 in the morning, and we finally made our ascent. As we were going back up to Minneapolis, when we reached the apex, this is about at the time when this experience happened. And I'd been sitting next to a man from New York City who was really, really, he was actually the organizer for the Republican and Democratic National Convention. And we were having a nice chit-chatty conversation. My mom was very political, and I enjoyed having this conversation with him. It kept my mind off of things. But I was getting very, very nervous and very worried at this point. And that's where I'm going to start reading you the story. I slumped back into my chair, almost lifeless. I actually seemed to morph and mold right into it, as if I was being directly fused into and absorbed by it. It was almost like losing a separate, distinct form all of my very own. I felt as light and as boundless as a butterfly. I had never in my life felt such a keen sense of tranquility or repose. I breathed in a deep breath of this transcendently supreme harmony, and then exhaled all that was in any way antithesis to this moment. I gave in to the beckoning paramount love, and then softly, gently, pleasingly, I closed my eyelids. With no sense of time, I was floating. It was as if I had left my body and taken flight. There was no sensation of bodily form left within me whatsoever, and all but the essence of pure space had vanished. Never in my life had I digested such a discriminating peacefulness, such a categorical cresting of quiet and relief. Gone were the voices that were proliferating below me. Gone were the droning of the oxygen-blowing peepers hanging above me, and the perpetual buzzing engines whipping up a frenzy below. Gone was the rustling of the books and the magazine pages, and gone were all the noises from the babies and the children. For all at once, I found myself in a place of intangible still, in a complete celestial calm. Before long, with no frame of reference whatsoever as to what was happening, a scene of such surreal prominence suddenly juxtaposed itself upon the emptiness of space in which I found myself, suspended. But I certainly cannot call this place my mind, for whatever it was I was now experiencing, one thing I knew for certain, it was not my mind. I was in a feathery sort of place, a state of some kind of beingness where I had never been before, a place, a state, what have you, which I could never have even imagined. But from what I can tell, based upon accounts that I have read, that others have penned, about taking hallucinatory drugs or anything such as this, I don't think any kind of a drug-induced hallucinatory trip could hold a candle to the place wherein I found myself encountered and pontooning. The place that was with such sheer and stalwart contentment, I was freely and willingly and easily able to abandon myself. It was a space of pure nothingness, yet a container of absolutely everything. It was a space that was wholly and entirely empty, but it was filled with all of infinity. It was a state in which everything there could be experienced at intensities that seemed to be miles off the Richter scale. The senses were magnified with a sharpness that was hypnotizing. But most intriguing of all was the fact that nothing there felt as if it originated out of the frame of reference we are accustomed to here in mortality. Here it is a subservient form of observation that we always use, and it comes from without. But everything born in this place sort of mushroomed from a place that was deep inside. It was heaven. All at once, before my eyes, I saw her. I saw her, and I was overcome. I was caught inside the framework of a submissively unconditional adoration that was coupled with astonishing awe. The entire well of the affections that were possessed within me, that were so boomingly mustered in that moment without a warning, were all at once directed at the most profoundly, the most strikingly, the most astonishingly beautiful creature I'd ever dared to see. She had immediately unfolded before my presence and then stepped forward with the sleekest style of immaculate. It was as if she herself was somehow some kind of a portion of purely unadulterated silk, or like satin, or maybe the finest cut of lace. And without one notice of fanfare, she had instantaneously emerged, stationed before what could be detected as an ominous sense of some type of overarching presence. She stood nobly aright, the stunning embodiment of emboldened breadth and brilliance. And there is such a description thereof I am not equipped with the words to say. She was stately, she was commanding, she was mesmerizing. She exuberated some kind of an unintelligible disposition of wholeness. She was absolutely astounding, and I felt nearly compelled to fall down at her feet to worship her. I could see her at first only from behind. Her presence was so immensely glorious, pure and holy, that I comprehended at once her worth to be truly enormously great. Magnificent beyond measure. I had never once inspected a woman so gratifyingly and so stunningly resplendent, and when she came forth, initially I spied her standing in a blinding white, in a vaporously airy kind of sight. It was as if the white submerged her, and it actually swallowed her up, daintily, delicately, ever so buoyantly. She herself was also completely clothed in a chicest sort of white from head to toe. Flowing like tresses, whatever was the fabric caressing her figure, it seemed to me like the tapestries of pure fluff translucently draped all around her, and all of them were far, far lighter than snow. The white in this place was like you could literally, unequivocally taste it. It was as if the tools of sight and taste and all the other human senses were no longer even distinguishable or separate or even needed. It seemed like everything there fused. In this spot of purely guileless, whitewashed space, all was taken in as an uncorrupted, a truly sanitary, a wholly unreferenced occurrence of being. And the entirety of whatever may have seemed to be parts was all melded. It was all there at an instantaneous once. And thus the white in her glow was transcendently delectable. This fantastical creature was absolutely staggering, and in her presence I openly wanted to candidly sob. Even when I was just beholding her from behind. Her hair was nearly black, pulled up at its sides somehow, and then lavishly sweeping down past her neck and spilling over to a point midway down her back. When I saw her hair, it was really important because I sensed this draw to her hair, and I wondered if there was something unique about her hair. And it was interesting because after the experience, when I came home to Minnesota and we prepared for her funeral, I had completely forgotten that when my mother was young and in her prime, she used to wear her hair the same way was in this vision, and I never even remembered that. There was undeniably something of secret significance to the appearance of her hair, judging from the way its style held me so pensively captive. She faced away from me, and she was clearly gazing outward and forward toward an indecipherable presence of some fashion that apparently lay somewhere directly above and before her, but which form or figure I could not see. I wondered at it curiously because I wondered what could be holding her so entranced and so enraptured and spellbound and so motionless, so at such a total restful peace. It was at this very moment that a question suddenly took shape and surfaced into my awareness with no detectable effort of my own. Who is this unbelievably magnificent creature, Cain, so carefully? And my sensibility kept speaking, saying, she's so incredible, she's unspeakable. I've never in my existence seen anything like this being. I must know, who could she be? As the first reply was carving its way into my consciousness, I thought I was conversing with myself, but very quickly I grasped the notion that I was listening. I was hearing a voice. It was outside of me. It was not my own voice, and it was holding some state of a holy communion with me, an anointed exchange of some kind. And after this first question had forged itself in my mind, it gradually dissolved itself precisely at the same time that an imperceptible but a very distinct vocal response echoed plainly back to me. It was heard as an intelligible and resounding and most reassuring directive. It simply said, watch. So I watched, and I obeyed. I fixated upon the scene a little while longer, and like a wave splashing over the sand, the spectacle before me washed away, stupendously glossed over by another of exact ultra-superiority. Presently, anon with veneration, this magnificent female creature of lavish light glanced ever so longingly upward, brought on above her into what appeared to be nothing but an endless air of sea. She was gazing up as if to be eagerly, adoringly, gratefully, and reverently anticipating something. And in an overjoyed state of elation, her overjoyed state of elation was only overpowered by what seemed to be an aristocratic ambience of mighty neatness. This woman was waiting a crowning. I looked up to where she was hence gaping and could subsequently but scarcely make out the image of two hands, as they had reached down from what seemed to be the absence of anything. They protruded out from what was whispered to my prudence to be a courtly hiding place, and then they extended themselves flawlessly toward her. Veiled above the forearms, I could not distinguish any kind of figure or likeness attached to or extended onward and upward from this extraordinarily distinguished pair of hands. The palms surfaced singularly alone, but endowed with these hands somehow reeked of power, purpose, accomplishment, and achievement, and they were a perfect representation all by themselves of attainment, of satisfaction, of preeminence and completion. It was clear that they would confer upon this formidable beauty some kind of a concluding and a final glory. As if she just ended in an uproarious race that had nearly cost her a royal place in the expanse of her eternities. I could scantily contain the shivers running up my spine when I spied the crown, held in the grasp of those descending hands and weightlessly lighting downward directly upon her till being arranged upon her head. The crown at first seemed exceedingly large, almost pretentious and ostentatious, but then it seemed to shrink in size as it settled upon her. That's the point in which the scene packed for me its biggest punch. It made it clear that the size of this inflated adornment indicated merely the magnitude of joy and reward personified. Its size had nothing to do with the top or base of physicality, temporal station, or monetary status. The woman graciously, paradisically glided gleefully forward, elevating herself up onto a white marble slab, and then positioned herself facing forward so as to move toward the middle of what seemed to be some kind of a luminous stone. It resembled a platform of sorts, a podium or a pedestal, a kind of pristine configuration, and immediately thereafter, this unfathomable fair female inched her way ahead, advancing until she was striding to the very center of this supreme structure. She appropriately knelt with deference, at evenly and ever so serenely, upon bended knees. She bowed in the most untainted, untarnished disposition of honor and homage. And this is the point I was overcome. I was weeping in tears. The entire environment was so ineffably incredible. I paused, gasping for air as I strove to savor the scene so perfectly pure. I too just waited. I did not want to move. I only wanted to stay in this spot, endlessly sponging up all the sweetness. And it was accurate at this fling in time that a second message came molding itself into my unfolding cognizance as the second question came. It said, oh, I see. This amazing creature must be a princess or something. She is so beautiful. I've never seen anyone like this, so impeccably lovely or exquisite. It must be a princess, and I was satisfied that her identity was one. But just then the voice answered in reverberation to me again, a near replica to the first, in ever such brevity, just watch. Oh, how clearly at this crossroads I knew this woman was being crowned. She was a princess, but as of yet, to me, she was a princess of unrenown. Even now, as I contemplate the superlative nature of these unmatched saints, I'm summoned to recall as a Latter-day Saint the stirring words of the founder of our faith. I feel secure they exemplify the omnipresent substance of this grand vision I was humbly surveying. And this is what it's written in one of our books of scripture. O God, where art thou, and where is the pavilion that covereth thy hiding place? Yes, this was the hiding place of God. I was fully persuaded in this very moment that I had somehow uncovered his hiding place. I continued to watch the consecrating arena unfolding before me, as the voice had advised, when the scene sort of sluggishly expanded. I then nightly noticed, almost like gradually discovering a fragrance hanging in the air, that this fair-featured maiden, still standing with her back facing toward me, had shifted her concentration. It was now transfixed, straight forward, into a far, far distance, vibrating someplace before her. And though I was not yet qualified to establish the semblance affixed to her countenance, I was politely pliant with the sensations of this moment, for I too was being invoked to gaze forward and onward toward a remote location that was far removed from me. There, in that intensified instance, just at the wink where I'd watched this elegantly refined woman being crowned, my wonderment was briskly directed afar off as if into a distant playhouse theater. When just then, like the flash of a nuclear blast, the burgeoning stage ahead of me auspiciously superimploded. And marvelously, miraculously, a providential vision surfaced squarely in front of her, and I looked past her and I could see its enormity. When I start off into that far distant reach where all my attentions had been simultaneously drawn, the most peculiar picture appeared. It was literally as if I could behold hundreds and hundreds of beings. No, maybe more like thousands. They were like the brassy reflections of what occurred to be something like frosty veiled beings. They were completely unidentifiable, but they were also very notable. It was as if I was seeing the simple silhouettes of statuesque-like figurines. They were concealed behind like a chalky kind of dusting of some kind, behind a milky type of bleach smog. I could not see the slightest details of one of the faces or their torsos, but it was apparent these were human beings, people, and they were copious. They were gathered in numbers that were innumerable, and all of them were ambling forward without delay like some kind of a unified billowing puff. They ever so smoothly, ever so solemnly, ever so serenely, they were wandering toward us and toward this invaluable woman and me. I watched and watched as they continued pressing forward to reach her, and the closer they came, the more I could see they were people. And all of them were joined in one purpose, to flock to her, summoned like sheep, convening to her imposing presence. Before long, they materialized right up to her company, and yet they remained behind this blinding, ivory daze. And despite the icy drapery of sorts that separated this lily woman from that most pleasing crowd, there was an inescapable superior sense of warmth that was emanating energetically from me, from the whole grouping. And it was, without question, definitely spellbinding. It was next to impossible to keep from feeling completely immersed and drowned by the enthralling draw. I bemoaned myself with a strong hunger to attain to their state. And then, as if in a perfect plan of preparation, two of them strode forward. They separated themselves out from the synchronized scene. And when they did this, it was as if they had been incarnated from another existence, almost like they had been released from a barred dimension or something. They obtruded through this misty room and slipped forward with sovereignty, and they came forward in a gated manner and stepped onto this pulpit-like stage where she was still standing. Then each of them came to her at her vacant sides. One of these imperially robed figures then treaded forward toward the woman from her left, and the other from her right. They were moving in perfect sync. I could not apprehend and still do not know if these majestic beings were male or female, but in the event, as the second subject to the right came forward to this woman's side, just then she twisted her head so as to follow somewhat of the more massive being's procession forward. And it was just then, when she wound herself sideways, that I at last could spy her profile. And with one sweep of lucid recognition, I instantaneously knew her familiar face. I knew it clearly. With just one undeviating glimpse of her twinkling in her eyes, my composure was breathtakingly overthrown forthwith. I finally authenticated the identity of this dazzling creature upon whom I've been so anesthetically riveted for this whole time. Without further pause, superfluous words glittered past my senses. Oh my gosh, was the only expression I could find. But then blurting out likewise, akin to a dynamite chiseling through a tunnel in my thoughts, I deciphered the words exploding, that is my mother. That breathtakingly beautiful woman is my mother. I was suddenly weak and fragile, almost as if I had, was at once breakable and almost numb. I was now more than undone. I was minus all my power, my potency, and my strength. This was my mom, and all the while that I'd obsessed with the beauty of this creation, she had been the portraiture of my very own mother. One more time again, in that split second, as I heard myself pronounce those words inside of me, the voice came again and recurred with a recurrent message to me the third time, just watch. When I looked one more time to behold, I saw those two spectacular beings step up to her sides, embracing her ever so cautiously, so affectionately by her shoulders, so as positively not to alarm her. Each one cupped their arms to the undersides of her arms, wrapping their fingers until they had clasped her upper biceps, and then locked themselves just underneath her armpits, at the joint sockets, curving but underneath both her appendages. And then at that exact moment, as they touched and enfolded her, she began ever so radiantly, ever so staggeringly to weightlessly ascend upward, like a kite that had just been cut free from every single one of its strings. She seemed to spiral silently upward, longingly, lucidly, and lovingly, with such an unwavering, awe-inspiring innermost desire, like a craving for some kind of an unseen mansion or manor that was laid out before her. As she rafted aloft toward what appeared to be a never-ending stretch for sky, in that very second I glanced upward to follow her ascension with my gaze, I began to cry profusely. I was beholding my darling mother, and I was beholding God's angels, and they were in a rapture, escorting my precious mama into the unlimited expanses of God's grandiose heavens. It was inconceivable and incommunicable. It was all just as unutterable as a lightning rod, rainbow, or butterfly is untouchable, and it parried my grasp. My mother was entering heaven. She was being taken home to God. And then, as if this whole scene were not enough to feel, as if it were somehow able to be truly received, while I viewed her rising, sobering words began again to stab my reason. But this time, they were my words, my own words of longing and my expressions of pain. All the others seemed to originate from some faculty outside of my own, but these were easily mine, part of my own. These were my expressions of bittersweet, unstoppable suffering and heartache. I did not want this being to go. I did not want this indefinable creature to leave my company's view. I wailed beyond telling as I realized she was now exiting my sight, and of course I wanted my mother to stay. So I spoke. To her I spoke, aloud I spoke, and it felt as if I was hollering after her in some sort of a hallowed way, in a total deference that was pinnacled with a proclamation of pure esteem. I registered promptly that she was going to quickly disappear, so I further petitioned from someone inside me, please do not go. I don't want you to go, Mom. Do not go. Do not leave. And then I wept, and I wept severely. And it was as if a waterfall of anguish and sorrow was sloshing down through a vacuum of voided words, and I moaned and I groaned extensively. I kept saying, please don't go, please don't leave me, please, please. But with these withering words, and in spite of all my hopes fixated like frozen ice upon her, she still rose, unpreventably. She just bounded right on up as if she were flying, like on eagle's wings, as God promised. And then I saw it. I saw it. I saw the most unutterable of all things. In one brief instant, I beheld the superlatively sublime. I wondered how it could be. How could I be really seeing what I was now seeing? What then began taking place was somewhat like the visions of what a person might be lucky enough to read, but was not anything I dreamed that a human could actually befall in a mortal being. As I chained my eyes upon my mama, yearning like a starving little girl holding out hope that by some slight chance of charity, my distressing pleas would be relieved, I held firmly to my prayer that she wouldn't leave. And then, while still watching, my true-rooted mother soaring unfailingly heavenward in the arms of such unknowable and ungraspable love, I detected myself likewise, in some unexplainable manner, being lifted and carried up with her contemporaneously Yes, I too was being canvassed skyward from some very far away outlying locality. But after only an exceedingly short length of time, I was stopped, curtly, far short of where it was that she was flying. And then by some puzzling and obscure instrumentality, I began to feel myself ushered into some kind of a reality fully unbeknownst to me. It felt as if I could palpably feel like a cathedral of some exalted and kingly conformation unaccountably doming itself straight above me, this whole landscape, and then amply arcing its path all the way over me. I stayed my vision zealously upon the object of my fond affections, unable to alter her course skyward through any of my own lamenting. She just continued going onward. But all at once, in the absolute line of my full-sighted view, above all of us, above me, above Mama, above the two angels that were conveying her to the Esalen I'd encountered in this unspeakable place, there arched a limited, almost exquisitely bejeweled panorama. I saw the full frameless firmament. It was stretched out across my view as I savored watching my precious mother endlessly ballooning. I beheld the entire uncontainable universe. It was laid out without bounds like an artist's sensational masterpiece. And right there, as my gaze prevailed, cemented to the scope of all that was happening, from the very center of this promising ceaseless space sprang forth the very face of the one and only, the everlastingly adored, my most excellently devoted immortal king. It was his face that I saw, and I could see it hanging over everything. It was like some kind of an astral umbrella, and I drank in his every astronomical feature. I was immersed therein. His form was by some kind of eternal competence or capacity, extending itself all the way across the sum of the whole divine expansion that was depicted before me. His express image was aspiring to one single aim. His Christ's brim-filled divine nature was staring right back, not exclusively at Mama and me, but at this whole untellable folding. It was like he was presiding over everything, over the whole electrifying setting. His image was spilling and splashing out plentifully, everywhere present, everywhere seen. His facial features and his presence, through some kind of a keen spirit formation, was in all things and through all things. It was like a non-stop mural sprawling out across the interplanetary basilica of the all-inclusive universe. His spirit countenance was actually in like some unrevealed way, almost as if it was the very essence of the universe. And then while all my faculties were pervading this whole dominion, this whole scene, while I was soaking in the very face of the one eternal Christ, every single one of my senses was quietly, casually brought back and nudged right back again to this one supernal moment at hand, to the final ascension of my dearly beloved. For then, I was without a doubt, I watched her winding and whirling still upward, and that is when I saw it. I actually seized the very instance that the pure and holy Christ not only was looking down through the amplitude of space at, but longing down through the amplitude of space for my treasured Mama. I saw the emancipated, all-consuming, loving desire in his all-seeing eye, and he bathed her in it. He called her forth from a mortal subsistence. He was inviting her gently forth to discard everything. I saw his eyes, and I saw how they doted upon our cherished, departing mother. I saw exactly how he felt in that precise moment for this priceless soul that he had crafted. It cannot be spoken what I saw him feel for my mother, and it cannot be uttered or spoke or said. How could I understand to any extent what I saw and feel for this woman he had fashioned and for the woman who had birthed and selflessly raised me? But then, I was reduced to a mere nothing, but then there are no words to describe what happened next. His eyes pierced the breadth of eternity, weeping for his beloved. And then, it was so much perfect love, it was adoration pouring. And then after the splendor I had felt gushing down all over me like the rushing of water or the splashing of the seas, I saw what happened next, and it could scarcely be received. After all this glory, after all this rich glory, after all this unspeakable devotion unleashed, in this one small clip of timing, in one instant, in one moment, I spied the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings as he transferred his all-piercing look of unrequited love from my transfiguring mother past her, and he looked at me. I saw my Savior, the God of all, and I saw him look at me. He sifted up every single of his sense of his reserved adulation, and for one moment, as if to magnetize the very air I breathed, he looked at me. There is no way to tell the look of love that was emanating from his eyes and from the fundamental nature. There is no way to explain it. I could not keep from weeping incessantly. My tears could not be contained. I now realized I had been privileged in my life to be born to a princess mommy, and I had been able to watch her as she was received. As I finished my final words, saying to my mother, "Please stay nearby me, Angel Mama. I will miss you beyond saying," she arose into the hiding place, into the heights of the heavens. She simply and sweetly, like a butterfly, finding its wings, vanished, evaporated into the glorious face of the Lord Omnipotent himself. My mother was captured and received. She was fully embraced into the bosom of our King. Finally at rest, she was gone, but she was home. She was in his loving arms. But that was what I experienced. And the thing that was most important of this whole experience was knowing that when I was there, there's no way to describe that peace. The most important thing was that there's no boundaries between human souls there. It's perfect. And what's released is the love and what you focus on. And so my challenge to you at the end of this, what I've shared with you today, is that maybe we can make that kind of an experience as much a part of our lives here as possible by where we put our focus. That's the important thing. Where do we put our focus? I prepare a little piece that my daughter helped me arrange. It's a song that I wrote about my mom. And I just wanted to tell you that I've always been a person of strong faith and belief. The one thing that happened to me after this experience is I didn't fear death anymore. I really didn't. I still wonder how I'll go, and I hope that it won't be as painful as what my mother went through. But the one thing I learned from my mother was that, like I said at the beginning, death is a portal. And it is a time, a most opportune time for change in your life. And it is a time that you can go forth into new things like a butterfly with the people that leave their light behind to you. I hope that by sharing this story with you that you'll have a chance to go forward and do that. The song is called Fly Away, My Mama Fly Away. And it's a song of celebration because there's, to me, three births in life. There's a birth into life, a birth into a spiritual life, and a birth into everlasting life. And my mother took that final step, and it was so wonderful to see and be a part of that with her. And it changed my life profoundly, and I hope that I've left something with you that has touched you, makes you want to go forward and be a better person and make this world a better place, because we need it, especially right now. And the last thing I want to say, in my faith, the Bible teaches that, I learned this long after I had the experience, but the Apostle Paul said at one point that he knew a man that was caught up to a third heaven, and that whether he was in his body or out of his body, he could not tell, but that he heard and saw unspeakable things. That was what I felt. I couldn't tell if I was in or out. That feeling that I had come over me, it was just so profound. What I learned is that the world, from there and here, mortality and immortality, it's like the sun. The sun is so bright that if you look at it with your naked eyes, you cannot look at it. It will cause your eyes to burn. But if you put on a pair of sunglasses, you'll be able to look at it for a moment, and it won't harm you. That's the same as what I learned about mortality and immortality, that Jesus talked about a transfiguration on the mountain when he took his disciples up in the mountain, and they saw other heavenly beings that came down. And what I learned is that there are these near-death experiences that people have, and like what I had with my mother, and I'm so grateful. I'm sure that she asked for me to be able to have that because I wasn't able to get there at the time, and I thank her for it. But what I learned is these experiences are like for a moment, that people are given this moment, like the sunglasses of mortality. They're put over our mortality, and we're given a moment where we can endure this incredible place we're going to be at some point together. So get used to each other. Get used to each other, you know, because, I mean, we can focus on the good or we can focus on the bad, you know. But you know what? The truth is, we are amazing beings. We are creations of something far beyond just what's happening here. So I hope that you take that away and then make your life a better life. And we'll sing this song for you. And then I'm going to show you one small little clip here at the end on the DVD. Okay?
Thank you.
me my mother, okay? Tell the people you love often that you love them. Okay, let's hope this works, everybody. This is the finale.